the National Assembly should recommend to the president that one of those people become the deputy chairperson. Now, I think the argument from Honorable Horn is that we must guard against a situation where a person can argue that he or she was excluded procedurally. That the procedure must not be in such a way that it excludes anyone who would have wanted to be a deputy chairperson, but the advert did not indicate that issue of a deputy. It just indicated commissioners, and the issue is whether the current serving commissioners, the process would inadvertently exclude them if they are not contacted, and we should guard against that. But now the third issue is, how do we have a process that take into consideration all of those issues, but still come up with two people and one of them being a deputy chairperson?
Sorry, sir.
Yes,
sir. Can I maybe just propose something, sir?
Okay.
Yes. The suggestion I'm bringing forward is that we've advertised for two positions for commissioners, right? Then we interview for those two positions. But before we interview that, we write a letter to the committee, to the current incumbents who are commissioners, and ask of them to motivate if one of them has an interest to become a deputy chair. Now, that process will start from next week of getting those motivations from the incumbents if they want to be deputy chair, because they were interviewed and they were fit to be commissioners. So in the aspect of trying to find out if they are fit for to be commissioners, that aspect is already covered. Yes. Now we would want to find out if they have capabilities to become the deputy. So they will motivate in their response and in showing us interest if they want to be deputies. Then when we interview the 10 candidates, we have two sets of questions. The first question is asking them their capabilities of becoming commissioner. Then the other set of questions will be assessing their capabilities of being a leader, leading, yes, which is covering the aspects of becoming a deputy commissioner, a deputy chair. Then after the interview process, we'll have the motivational letters from the incumbents and the results from the candidates we interviewed. So we'll have the same information before us, having checked the capabilities of the candidates we've interviewed and having to check against the motivational letters from the incumbents. Then we choose from that results who will be the deputy commissioner, I mean the deputy chair. When we report to the House, we report in that fashion, who will be?
Except that I agree with everything, except that the issue of just motivation, it will lack transparency. Because everything must be done in an open, transparent manner. So we didn't want to be challenged on the issue, on the lack of transparency. So with everything, I was following you and I was agreeing with you, but I have a challenge with that later part. Honorable Breitenbach?
Sorry, it's my whole hand again.
So.
Sorry, Chair. Quickly, as just said, my apologies again. Or with regard to the transparency, if we then receive the motivational letters from the incumbents, we'll give them a due date before our interviews. Then if we receive two or three or four who has an interest, we'll then have to add them in our list for interviews, but their questions will only be based on the leadership capabilities.
Second part.
Yes.
That is what I was suggesting. That is yes. Because they have to be interviewed, but firstly, you must take into account that they were interviewed and they passed the interview. They were recommended as commissioners. But now you should test their competencies on their ability to lead, which would be the second part. And I think that is the part that Honorable Janji was not yet comfortable with. What is your view now, Honorable Janji?
Yeah, I see we're joined by people for the next item. I can see that. Look, Chair, it's not a trade smash, whatever that we do, because now it is about the method we use in achieving the same thing. I wouldn't go to war for it, but as long as whatever that we do, because I'm watching anything.
Mm.
You know, when you're dealing with interviews, it's the rights of candidates have got to be, I mean, a respected and secured throughout the process. Because these are litigious issues, either way you look at it. So if anything that has been put forward by Sia, which you agree, Chair, which was the earlier suggestion that was made, it is such that nothing that we'll do out of that process will open us up to any risk of flouting the procedures and processes. I'm happy with that, because the main thing that you must understand is that we're doing these interviews responding to an advert. That's the basis of our work, basically, and we're adding on to that because we want to be efficient, we want to be expeditious, and not waste resources. We're adding the other element. I think the way we add it must just make sure that it doesn't compromise our processes, doesn't infringe on any of these candidates' rights in doing that. But I I'm not raising that because I see a problem, but there's always a possibility that you can be challenged. But if we put our things together in such a way that it is so tight, it's proper, it's followable, and it's transparent throughout the interviews, I am very comfortable then with that. Even what I've said, that you always want to manage, because when we rise, Your take is that we must have completed this process. And I think that's the pressure that, as our leader, that you have as a chair of the committee. And I am for that.
No, thank you very much. I think we can leave it at that, and that we would have these two sets of questions. No one would be unduly advantaged. The issue, the process is going to be transparent. We would write letters. Sia, can I sign them at least tomorrow, so that by Monday they must receive those letters for the commissioners to respond, and then we will discuss between me and you the due date for them, and then we will prepare two sets of questions to test. One's eligibility to be a commissioner, and then the other one's eligibility to be the deputy chair. All candidates will go through that, and then but the commissioners that are already serving will go through the part B. Can we now do the selections in terms of the criteria that was adopted? Can I note hands? Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to nominate Dr. Lenny Hubert. He was shortlisted previously from our perspective. Thank you. Do you just want one nomination at this stage?
Are you only
one from each.
Okay. Is Dr. Lenny Hubert?
Len Hubert, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, sorry?
No, you've got it right. Thank you.
Okay. Other parties, other members?
My hand is up, Chair.
Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to nominate Ms. Bidhu Vendelankar.
Vendelank.
Yeah. Vendelankar.
The former CEO of Legal Aid for Bulumfuke.
Fatima Ismail Khan.
Sorry?
Fatima Ismail. Ismail Kohan.
Kohan, okay.
I nominate her.
Thank you very much. Honorable Jelle. Honorable Jelle. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. the name now, nominated sounded very much like the name I want to nominate, but it's not exactly the same, so maybe you can just determine. I want to nominate Feridel Ishmael Adam.
Who? Can you repeat, Honorable Horn?
Ms. Feridel Ishmael Adam.
Feridel Adams, okay. Honorable Chanji.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Nomashlube Kwinana.
Kwinana. Okay, thank you. Number six. Honorable Jale, are you back? Honorable Jale?
She's not Chair. Can I come in?
Okay.
Nomfundo Gobodo.
Nomfundo Gobodo, okay. Honorable Swart. Honorable Swart.
I have a nomination for Reverend Moss and Clow.
Hello?
Moss and Clow. NT.
What?
NTLHA, Moss and Clow.
Mosetla.
Yeah. No, Entla. NT.
Entla.
Yeah.
Okay. Honorable Nola.
Yes, I rise to nominate Emil Mpubi.
Honorable Nola.
Yes, I rise.
Who?
Philile Ntuli.
Philile
Ntuli.
Philile Ntuli, okay. Honorable Jale?
I'm not sure, Chair, because I missed you somewhere. No Fundo, Koboto.
Yes, she has been nominated.
I have another name, too. Because that one has been nominated. I didn't hear other names. Nomahubi Kwinana.
That has been done. That has been done, Honorable Chela.
You want to catch up?
I'm saying that is.
Sibanyoni Ben. Jonas.
Sibanyoni.
Oh, I rest my case.
Okay. Honorable Mfuke.
Advocate Mohammed Amir Meya.
Amir
Meya.
Yeah. Any other hand? We have ten names now. Any other hands?
And we have agreed on 10. Maybe we might stop it there.
Is there a proposal to close nomination?
I propose closure, Chair.
Is there a seconder?
Yes.
Seconded. So these are the names. Dr. Denny Hubert, Ms. Vindlaka, Fatima Chohankota, Cheryl Adams, Mashubi Kinana, Mfundo Kogoto, Musetla Entla, Shili Lentuli, Sibanyeni Jonas, Advocate Amir Mia. Those are the names, honorable members, that would be interviewed on the 9th and 10th. Is that in order?
Thank you, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your cooperation, honorable members. Can we now deal with the sexual offenses? Mr. Dupriz has been waiting for some time. Our apologies, Mr. Dupriz. We had to deal with these pressing issues before we start with the bill. Our apologies. I know that you joined around 25 past one, so we have been patiently waiting. Our apologies. Thank you very much. Can you lead us, Mr. Dupriz?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I would just like to ask Ms. Ina Buerta to maybe just do a few introductory remarks, and I'm going to try and please bear with me, share the screen with our working document number 2. Thank you, Chair.
Good afternoon, Chairperson and all the members. Thank you for the opportunity to engage further with you on this very important piece of legislation. I haven't seen the name of the name of the deputy minister there, but I know he's involved in some other engagements today. But if he's not there, I just would like to make a few remarks. The first is that you would have noticed if you look at the working document, there are a number of clauses, and in respect of many of these clauses, we have different options. What Mr. Dupriz will do is, because of the fact that some of the options are very close to one another, he will take time to explain to the committee what is the difference so that you can make an informed decision and guide us in this regard. I also just want to say is that we realize that the document before you is not refined already and ready for. So first need to look at the principles involved in those clauses or in many of the clauses, and then we can fine tune it according to your guidance. And then, yes, Mr. Dupriz will take you through the document. The one thing is that I want just the members to be aware of that if you look at the working document, you will see we start off with offences. Actually, the first one is with the register. Then we go over to offences. And later on, we come back to the big issue about the register. And as you have seen from the previous comments, questions have been arisen as to whether we need to keep the register or whether the employers must go directly to SAP. And of course, what we then may decide on the earlier decisions or the earlier versions of the clauses may have an impact on what's decided later. Thank you very much, and I would like him to just share with you take you through the document. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Popper.
Thank you very much. I just want to confirm that you can see the working document on your screen. Mr. Chairperson, can you hear me?
Yes, we can see the working document.
Thank you, Chair. And then I would just like to mention to you that there is a thunderstorm on its way in our direction, but hopefully we will be able Chair, yes. I'm going to go straight in our working document to the first important issue to be decided by the committee. And that is the options that we have prepared with regard to the incest provision. You will recall that this option one that we see, we presented to the committee previously, and that was primarily to address the concerns by expressed by SACS. The committee requested us. Now, here we attempted to bring in an objective test in order to determine whether the specific act of sexual violation should be criminalized or not. The committee requested us to start maybe to look at a subjective or a reasonable child test. And that is the option two that we present to you today, Mr. Chair, where we indicate that the act of sexual violation was of such a nature that the child is, after the commission of this act, reluctant to participate in such an act. Again, however, we would like from the department side to present the third option to you, where we fall back on the objective test, and we say that the act of sexual violation was of such a nature that it was inappropriate or reprehensible for the adult person to have acted in that manner under the circumstances concerned. We have discussed the three options with the SOCA unit of NPA and the sexual offenses, prosecutors, the trainers of those prosecutors. They indicated to us that they support option three, but that the word inappropriate could possibly be deleted because the word reprehensible then covers the term inappropriate, and we agree with them. So, yes, Mr. Chair, we were requested to only provide you with two options, but we strongly recommend that the committee consider approving option three, but we have now the three options there. Moving on, Mr. Chair, I'll pause for questions.
Can you deal with the three options? We know that your view is option three, but can you also cover the other options? What is the difference between option three and the other options?
Certainly, Chair. Option one was the option that we presented to the portfolio committee in our working document one, and that was aimed to address the concerns that was expressed by SACS. The specific concern is that the loving parent who show affection to his or her child might fall or might be subject to prosecution. And that is why we have those underlying words in highlighted in yellow for you, where we attempted to draw in or express precisely what we would like to be criminalized, and that is then, of course, that the act of sexual violation was committed in such a manner that it violates or offends the sexual integrity or dignity of that child. This option was debated previously in the committee, and as a result thereof, and the concern that was expressed that it might appear that we are conflating subjective and objective tests, the request by the committee was that we prepare a second option where we focus on the state of mind of the child, in other words, the more is subjective of them, or them possibly even a reasonable child test. The and that then relates to the fact that the act of sexual violation was of such a nature that the child is, after the commission of the act, reluctant to participate in such an act again. This is a very, this option two was very difficult to draft, Mr. Chair, and it might seem odd that we have to say that the child was, after the commission of the act, reluctant to participate in that act, because incest is a consent-based offense. So that is why we have to say that that the child was after the act that was committed, not reluctant to participate in that act again. And then the third option is then purely an objective test with regard to the unlawfulness of the act itself. And that is where we say that, or propose that, the act of sexual violation was of such a nature that it was inappropriate or reprehensible for the adult person to have acted in that manner under the circumstances concerned. This is purely an objective test, and it was supported by the NPA. Chair, I will maybe allow time for questions now.
Thank you very much. I have the following hands, Honorable Mola and Honorable Stephen Swart. And Honorable Horn. Honorable Mola.
No, Chair, it's an old hand. I forgot to lower my
hand. Okay. Honorable Stephen Swart.
Thank you, Chair. This is very helpful. From the original draft, in my view, it's not really necessary, but it does clarify matters. I would support option three. But just bear in mind, this relates to the so-called accusation of this whole bill when we passed it to be the kissing bill that criminalizes kissing. Now, that was never the intention. And as I've argued before, the rule de minibus non curat lex would have resulted in no criminal action being following a parent kissing their child, where it is not inappropriate, or here, as it is now said in the third option, that word inappropriate is now going to be removed, reprehensible. So I think it makes it very clear in that regard. But, and that just buttresses the argument that there would be the de minibus rule would also be applicable. I just wanted to ask Mr. Dupuy, I didn't quite understand where you said incest. I misheard you. Maybe incest about being consent or non-consent based offense, surely. I just wanted to get clarity in that regard. Surely a child can't consent in any case. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I want to say also we are grateful that the department comes back with different options. In respect of option two, I have my reservations, Chair. I'm not sure whether a valid test talking about a reasonable child can be developed. The law takes as it is due notice of the unpredictability and the inherent, I want to say, unreasonableness due to the immaturity and the status of being a minor of children. So I would agree with the Honorable Swart that if we are to move for another formulation to address the concerns, option three seems to be best suited.
Okay. Those were the hands for now. And let's go to the next clause.
Can I just get a response on the issue about consent? Yeah. I don't quite understand it.
Okay, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, yes, thank you, Chair. The offence currently of incest reads that a person, persons who may not lawfully marry each other on account of conjugality, affinity, and adoptive relationship, and who unlawfully and intentionally engage in an act of sexual penetration with each other are, despite their mutual consent to engage in such an act, guilty of the offence of incest. Now, without, and trying to avoid a long-winded answer, a person under the age of 12 cannot consent to the sexual act. A person between the ages of 12 and 16 can consent to a sexual act, but the consent in terms of sections 15 and 16 are irrelevant for purposes of prosecuting the statutory rape and statutory sexual assault provision or offences. And then we must also take into consideration that there's the age category of 16 to 18, where consent is involved legally, if I might put it that way, but that category of persons are still being regarded as children. So that is why I say that incest is a consent-based thing, because that is exactly the requirement. If there is not consent involved, or if the person, for example, who is 11 years old, cannot give consent, then it will, of course, be a question of prosecuting an offence of rape. Chair, I don't know whether Mr. Swart would like to maybe respond, but if not, then I'll proceed.
I proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Option one was also presented to the committee previously. We indicated to the committee that there was submissions made to the committee where the persons concerned were expressed the view that the requirement of an indirect threat is overbroad. The department then indicated to the committee that it might be more appropriate to simply just remove the requirements of a direct or an indirect threat, and also to describe or define who a third party is. A third party, of course, in relation to a person B. But Mr. Chair, and I'm still trying to figure it out, I don't know why we originally did this, and we listed offences, but we didn't list all the offences that can be committed in terms of the Sexual Offences Act. So we would like to present you with the second option, and that is merely to omit the list of offences and to refer to then any sexual offence being committed in terms of the Act. We've also defined who a third party is, and that is a person or who is a member of the family of the victim or any other person in a close relationship with the victim. So then we omit the list of offences, we include all offences, and we say that if you unlawfully or intentionally utters or conveys a threat to a complainant that inspires a reasonable belief of imminent harm in the then offence of sexual intimidation is being committed. And then we would also like to recommend, in line with an existing provision in the Act, which is Section 55, that a person may be liable on conviction to a punishment to which a person actually having committed the sexual offence would be liable. So the department would like to recommend option two then as a better option, if I may say so, as option one. Chair, I'll wait for questions.
Okay, any questions, members? Honorable Nibot Drachen?
Thank you, Chair. I understand if the list of all the offences are removed and you just add all sexual offences, but then my question is in the definition of all sexual offences, what is the definition? What does that mean? Some people might say that I didn't have the list. I didn't know that that was a sexual offence. So if you include the terminology of all sexual offences, is it mentioned somewhere else what a sexual offence constitutes? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Tinkovic.
Yes, we do have the definition of sexual offence in Section 1 of the Act, and it specifically indicates to us all the offences in the Act. But I would like to, and this is a very important question, I would just like to mention one other thing, and that is why we also decided to move away from a list of sexual offences, because the Cybercrimes Bill will in future affect amendments to the Act which will introduce new sexual offences. So they will automatically be included then. So it's technically much more appropriate to follow the list. Thank you, Chair. Moving on, Mr. Chair, and apologies. There are many. Those are the two substantive provisions dealing then with offences, and we are now moving over to the proposed amendments to Chapter 6 of the Act. And you will recall that the committee started the debate during the previous committee meeting whether the registers should remain with the National Registrar for Sex Offenders or whether it should be moved to the South African Police Service. So strictly speaking, Mr. Chair, we did not affect too many amendments here. We still do have the approach where from clause 5 onwards, it's mainly the provisions as introduced in the introduced version of the bill. What we would like to indicate to the committee is that due to the extension of the definition of a vulnerable person, many commentators expressed their concern that the requirements of access to and even congregate would draw the net simply too wide. So there's two options for the committee possibly to give us guidance on, and that is either the requirements of access to and congregate could be restricted to children and persons who are with disabilities, or which might be at this stage, according to the department, possibly the more appropriate approach is to simply omit those requirements. So, and this is where it becomes relevant, the note that I've just indicated to you. At this stage, we attempted to propose to the committee that the requirements of access to congregate should be restricted to persons, to children or persons who are mentally disabled, and then also the persons referred to in paragraph D of the definition of person is vulnerable. That's the one option, or the first option. The second option would be to delete the requirement of access to or congregate. So that is a matter that will still, the requirement would like to receive the committee's guidance. So under the definition of an employer, those are then the options there. Maybe I should pause here for a moment, Mr. Chair.
But before you ask us for direction, I think the options here would be much clearer if we know the definition of a vulnerable person. or a vulnerable group. So why have you defined it?
Indeed, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go to that now. And the option one under the definition of person who is vulnerable was presented to the committee at the previous meeting. And we explained to the committee that the proposed amendment to the definition is of a technical nature, and we have explained to the committee why we would like to bring in that technical amendment. If we have kept the term there, we would have actually reduced or brought about a reduction in the rights of the persons who are already covered in terms of the Act. So option one then aims to define a person who's vulnerable as a child or a person who's mentally disabled, and both those terms are defined in terms of Section 1 of the Act. Then a female under the age of 25 years, a person who's being cared for or sheltered in a facility that provides services to victims of crime, and then also persons with physical, intellectual, or sensory disabilities who receives care, and then also persons who are 60 years or older and also finds themselves in facilities that provide care. Now, at the previous committee meeting, the committee requested us to prepare the second option, where we were requested to see or to point out to the committee how far we can extend the list or the definition of a person who is vulnerable. And the main request there related to persons who are among the LGBTQI plus community. Now, the paragraph F thing of option two is the new proposed paragraph, Mr. Chair, and we have inserted the list, person who is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, asexual, or queer. We are concerned to use those terms. So what we would like to propose is, instead of under option two, if it is approved by the committee, to avoid using those terms and possibly try to be more neutral in a sense, and that is to refer, for example, to a person with the characteristic that identifies that person as a member of a group that recognizes itself as transgender, intersex, or according to its sexual orientation. And then the option two is a rewording of option one. So there are two options that the committee could consider instead of using the terms. And then, Mr. Chair, we also...
Chairperson. Go out of it and on the option one and two. I hear what, no, you are okay. I'm still there. Please go back. Yes, I want to say on F that the persons who is lesbian, gay, and all that, and the other thing saying that the options that you are thinking of is this A, one, or two. I want to check with you. Did you check with the community or the organizations that are in this position? Because I know that they prefer to be called LGBTQI+. So if we are going to be back and diving in how we have to actually name them, it's a problem. I think it's simple. It's like the people with disability, they'll tell you that nothing for us without us. So let us not think for them. Let us get information or find out from them, because those organizations are active. We know them and get the right wording for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nebo Drachan.
Thank you, Chair. Just with regard to that, I'm fine with it, but I just wanted to clarify, because you left out, for example, you say other than from a family member. So then it has it listed, other than, should it include both? Or is it only people in institutions? But does it also include those who are cared for by family members, or those that don't even live in a care facility? So I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you very much. Mr. Duclos.
Thank you, Chair. I have made a note under paragraph F. Thank you, Chair, for the proposal that we should consult. And it's technical. We won't be able to use an abbreviation without defining that abbreviation in any event. And then with regard to excluding family members, that is unfortunately, I think, the harsh reality of what the chapter 6 or the ambit of chapter 6 is all about. And that is that it is restricted to a prohibition in respect of employment. It would be difficult for a family member to apply for a certificate if they are not in an employment situation. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, Mr. Chair, now we're going to get to this, the interesting or the saucy part of this definition. And I'm going to request Ms. Boeta to provide the answers to the many questions that the committee members are going to have now. But paragraph H, you will remember, Mr. Chair, that at the previous committee meeting, the question was raised whether it would be possible to empower the minister to make subordinate legislation to extend the definition of vulnerable person. And we've made a note here, and we've indicated Dr. Lewis made the proposal in her document to the committee that paragraph H could be included in the definition of vulnerable person, who would then empower the minister to extend the list by means of subordinate legislation. However, I would like to also remind the committee that Dr. Lewis also indicated that moving in this direction might be to veer into territory of thin ice. We've included her wording here. If the committee accepts the proposal, I would like to indicate at this early stage already that the wording might change a bit, but then of course we'll discuss that with Dr. Witt. She also proposed that apart from this paragraph H, then the regulations provisions also be amended to provide for or to cross-reference to this paragraph H. But as I indicated, Mr. Chair, you will recall that it was as a result of the request whether it would be possible to empower the minister to make subordinate legislation to extend the list. The department does not support the proposal, and with your permission, I would like Dr. Boeta or Ms. Naboeta to maybe address you in this regard.
Can I proceed, Chair?
is, are you going to be talking to the issue of subordinate legislation?
Yes, that's right, Chair, if you want to hear me on that.
Yes, and I think after you, if Dr. Lewis would want to make any comments, she's also welcome. You can proceed, Ms. Porter.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairperson. I think indicated is that Dr. Lewis did draw our attention to the possible impact of the delegation of this power to the executive. What I want to say is that my personal view is that she said we are moving on thin ice. I will go and take it one step further and say we are moving on no ice. The reason why I'm saying so is there's two factors that I think, and it also comes out very strongly from her document, that we need, when you think about what legislation can be delegated to the executive, you think about what the CC has said in many judgments about, in terms of, I think it's section 44 of the Constitution, the Parliament must make the law. And then also the second important thing is that the executive must implement the law. So if we go back to the issue of the Parliament must make the law, the court has also emphasized a lot the issue of manner and form. And what I mean by manner and form is you're all aware of the specific procedures that are made provision for in the joint rules, as well as the rules of the National Assembly and also in our cabinet prescripts, that for a bill you need to follow a certain procedure. And there's a lot of emphasis on consultation. There's a lot of emphasis on who must take the final decision in this regard. Now, I want to go to the second aspect, and then I'll just go to the first aspect again. The second aspect for me is that it is very strange that nowhere in the Constitution there's expressly provision for delegation of the making of legislation to the executive. But there is recognition in one of the sections, like Section 101 of the Constitution, so we all accept that still stands. The problem is that you must look at what is it that you want to delegate. Are you delegating the making of the law function, or are you delegating and just giving the executive the power to put flesh to what is already in the Act? Now, my concern with delegating this and giving the power to the minister to amend, apart from the question whether he can add or whether the minister will also be able to omit, that's another issue. But for me, what is important, I cannot see how this power can be seen making of implementing legislation. I've no doubt that it refers back, if you look at its definition and you look at what is the what are the consequences of if you broaden that category or not. You know, it has to do with certain obligations that are placed on certain employers. So for me, that is very important. Just to say, and I think maybe people might say this is like, it's not very significant. But to show, the courts also say you must comply with whatever the law requires. And what does constitute compliance? For purposes of determining that, you must look and say, what is the purpose of the purpose of the delegation, And then if you look at the purpose of the delegation also, you will see normally you only delegate things that are very technical, that are fast changing and so forth and so forth. Now, if I look at this, and then I can't see anything of those reasons here. I think my question will mainly be, if I must play devil's advocate, to say, why? What is the reason for us or the committee or parliament to want to give this power to the minister? Because I think it's really a fallacy that the making of regulations are likely shorter than that of bills. Many of the requirements that are applicable to the bills are also applicable in a sense to the regulations. But also, if you look at that approach that Parliament must make the law, we look at issues like, for instance, our President has a role to play. The President has the final say on whether a bill will go through or not. Even if you try to put in the safeguards that we have discussed previously, and I think that Dr. Lewis referred to in a document, is to say, okay, but let's give the power to the minister, but the safety mechanism is you must get the approval of Parliament. I don't think that safety mechanism will save this provision from being found unconstitutional, especially, as I said, because of the fact of what is the effect of what you are doing and what you are busy with here. So from our side, we are really very concerned about giving the minister that authority, even with the condition that the parliament must approve. We are of the opinion that you as parliament must look and decide at this point in time who must be part of the vulnerable groups. They're not going to change overnight. So we won't have the justification to say why we've delegated it. So that is our concern, that we shouldn't go this route. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Chairperson. Good afternoon, members and colleagues. I am very grateful that Tehink and Ina pointed out that, I did point out that there's very thin ice. The question that the committee put to me in the opinion that was delivered is that, is it possible? And our office went through that exercise with the Credit Act as well. Is it possible? In theory, yes. But like I said, in the opinion, I can't test that in practice. There is the consideration of public participation and consultation that was pointed out. I agree. The final decision aspect is there. I agree that those are the concerns and things that the courts look at when deciding whether it is a delegation of a plenary power. And Parliament can't delegate plenary power. So I absolutely agree with that. The issue with the flexibility, Ms. Boita, Dr. Boita said now that it doesn't change that often, that it justifies. That I got conflicting positions on in the readings that I did. Internationally, they prefer to keep such terms as database violence and all of that very flexible, because they say it does change and one can't pinpoint it necessarily. So that was the one aspect that led me to the flexibility. Ultimately, the suggestion to the committee was, and I said that walking a very fine line is that type of approach of Parliament keeping the reins and pointing to something that is flexible and can't be determined by Parliament right now for future use. So those are all grey areas, and I can't test that against what the Constitution will do with that, or Constitutional Court will do with that right now. If the decision was up to me, I agree with Dr. Boita. A definition isn't the ideal place to put something like this in. It is, the ice that I'm standing on is see-through. I don't like risks. in something like this, and this for me is very risky. If we can, like, I can be very cowboy and say that yes, this will absolutely be fine. I unfortunately I'm not somebody that carries risk well, so I'm not that cowboy. So yeah, the committee asked me, is it theoretically possible based on what our office has previously advised on different bills and also in different contexts? In theory, it is possible. Would I personally advise a route like this? No, I think the risk is huge and the ice could be cracking. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, members. But I would think that this might amount to abdication, not even delegation. We can't delegate a definition to a minister. I think let's try and remove the minister from this.
Having difficulty hearing.
Oh, I understand that it might even amount to abdication, not delegation. I think let's try and remove that power of defining. Let's try and remove it from the minister. Is illegitimate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Honorable Horn, before Mr. Dupris.
Thank you, Chair. And allow me to say up front that in principle, I think the advice is sound, and that we as Parliament must also learn from previous experiences, and that if something is within our authority, but also our responsibility, we should embrace it. But may I also, using the words, I think, of Mrs. Buerta, in playing the devil's advocate, ask the following question. Isn't the lawmaking responsibility simply to determine by way of making a law that certain protection must be given to vulnerable persons, and then determining whether a group or a person is part of the vulnerable, the group of vulnerables who should be protected, ultimately is largely a policy choice. Also, and I'm asking this also on the basis of the admission that it will not be possible to conclusively and with finality define the concept. So I'm just with respect from where I'm sitting, and as I say, as a matter of principle, I'm all for Parliament having to exercise the duties it has in terms of lawmaking. I'm not convinced that the whole issue of who is vulnerable is not rather a policy choice. And there's also ample authority from our courts that ultimately policy choices rests with the government of the day. So I want to ask whether that aspect has been properly considered by the department and Dr. Lewis in finalizing their advice.
Mr. Chair, I would like to immediately provide you with an answer from my angle of approach, but I'm also going to request Ms. Buerta to provide you possibly with a more technical request answer. The way in which the question was phrased now, for me, boils down to two things. First of all, you want the minister to interpret a term in legislation that is supposed to be defined in the legislation itself, and then the requirement that whatever the minister does must be subjected to approval by Parliament. In a cynical sense, one could argue that is merely legislating by remote control. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, with your permission, if I could add to that.
Proceed.
Chair, I agree with what was just explained, and I would also just like to point out that when we legislate, our laws need to provide a certain degree of, or in its provisions, must give a degree of certainty as to the scope of the law. So, yes, there are examples of where some of the like applications of laws is given to the executive, and that's a lot. But in its main focus, the law must give you the clear boundaries within which that application can take place. There you're also looking at the principle of legality. Somebody must know where the boundaries of legislation is for them to make regulations. With that said, also the case law regarding plenary power and the delegation of plenary power is very clear about the fact that as soon as you have a broad delegation, you will be in the realm of unconstitutionally delegating plenary power. So opening up that by just saying the concept of vulnerable person or vulnerable group and leaving that up to the interpretation, as Advocate Greta said, for the minister to determine, that I respectively submit puts us squarely in the realm of unconstitutional. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I think we're a little bit clearer now on that issue.
Okay, if I can just add, I fully agree about what was said. I'm just trying to make it for myself more easy to explain, and that is the question of, you make a distinction between making law and then implementing law. And like Dr. Lewis said, is that it's Parliament that must make the law. There must be certainty. They gave you the whole framework. All that what we as the executive need to do is to put flesh to that, saying is, how must this be done? And who is going to do this? In what manner this person is going to do that? So for me, the big thing is here that I cannot see how a court will ever interpret this granting of this power to the minister as part of implementation of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we agree on one thing that things as they stand, delegating this to the minister to define vulnerable groups will be unconstitutional. Let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've also prepared an option 3 for the committee to consider, where it is proposed that the definition should be restricted to the most vulnerable of persons who are vulnerable. And in paragraph B, the real change is, and that is where females under the age of 25 years are referred to as those females who receive tuition at a higher education college, a higher education institute, or a university college, as defined in the Higher Education Act. But we would also like to indicate, Mr. Chair, that apart from that category of persons, one could possibly also extend the definition to include, for example, university, females going to the university who stay in hospitals, etc. So with regard to option 3, we would also like to receive the committee's guidance in that regard. I don't know whether I should possibly pause for questions on option 3, Chair.
Thank you. Any questions on option 3? And none.
Swartje, Chair.
Honorable Swartje.
I'm just trying to think of whether there are other categories of women under the age of 25 that would be at some form of a interim, some form of education, whether that covers every possible vulnerable woman tuition. higher education institution. I'm just concerned about what about, for example, a woman that is doing a beauty course. Would that, and those are much broader, but I just don't want it to be exclusive to only educational institutions. Would there not be other institutions where you, for example, are doing apprenticeships, where you would also be vulnerable? I just want it also to be a bit, maybe to look a bit broader. In that regard, you have various people that are doing something that might be aligned to education, but something along those lines. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Short. Honorable Mfuke.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Honorable Short is actually taking us somewhere. There are young women that you find at the age of 25. They are doing internship, or some of them are with companies where they are going to learn about their jobs, and that's where many things are happening. We should not lose sight of it. And I agree with Honorable Khan to say that let us not just be on a specific higher education. There can be any other places that those people can find themselves vulnerable. And there are many examples. I mean, even in hospitals, we know that the young doctors that are actually there, you find that they are on their community service. They come across a lot of challenges, but because a person wants to find herself or himself, even boys, being in a certain position, they keep quiet and they will raise issues later. Let us not confine it into one space. And I agree with Honorable Horn.
Thank you very much. Can we proceed?
Can we just add the internships as well? I see. That was the word I was looking for. I don't think apprenticeship. Yeah, internships.
Can we get something that is going to take into account all the issues we have raised? Because I think if we throw in few, it is going to create a problem of excluding quite a number of areas of vulnerabilities. But I would even think about those who are in the defense force. There's a strong possibility of such things happening. So if maybe we can look at it, Mr. Dupree, and Ms. Borden, it can be omnibus that can cover quite a number of the concerns that the members have raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, it's Honorable Wilmer. Apologies for interrupting, and thank you. Learnerships in South Africa, we often use the term learnership rather than internship. So maybe that's another term that you could look at as a omnibus term to use.
Yes, yeah. Let's try and, because somebody was talking about even taxi ransom. So let's try and find something that is going to express our fears and that catches all of those issues that the members have raised.
Because this part is very broad, and I'm looking at also, remember, we have also those organizations that are with us. And they are also saying that their taxis are vulnerable for women, especially those in higher education, but also a number of jobs, you know. And I think that we should be now and then checking on the online also spaces, and we should be checking on the interaction with our communities and our organizations, because they've been part of the process, so that we don't leave them out.
Okay. Honorable Porter.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say is I was just thinking about all our assistant nurses. They all work shifts from 7 to 7. And we know at 7 o'clock at night, it's already dark in winter, and they are at risk as well. The other thing I want to raise is, and my understanding may be wrong, but my understanding is that you can get a 19-year-old pupil at the basic school still. It's only if they are beyond 20 or 21 that they are channeled through to the colleges. So I think it's just important that we make sure that, because what's going to happen here is we say females under the age of 25 years. So in that sense, maybe then we can say it will include a person who is in grade 12, but who's 19 years old. But if we go for another option, like the option where one of the options I saw, then we may sit with a difficulty. So I think that we will have a look at the flexibility, how we can draft it. But I must say up front that this is one of the more difficult definitions that I've come across for a long time, but we will try our best to take into account what everybody has said.
Yes, no, I do sympathize with this. I think it's one of the most difficult ones. But let's try and show that we take into consideration all what the members have said and come up with a workable definition.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And Ms. Butta is my senior, and I have to respect her views, but I'm going to disagree with her on the example she just used. Because if you are at a school, there are children, irrespective of how old they are, then you must vet your employee. So to try and make an exception for a person who's 19 years old and still, for example, in grade 11, is irrelevant. We don't need to go there because we are already covering children at schools. So the teachers will be vetted. I just wanted to mention that to you, Chair. And we're going to move on now. And the next definition then, of course, as introduced, it's necessary for us to define the term sexual offence for purposes of Chapter 6. In the comments to the committee, it was indicated to the committee that there are a number of concerned parties who expressed the view that the retrospective operation of the definition will cause problems when the term vulnerable persons are extended beyond the current two categories. The department came up with the proposal at the previous committee meeting that it might be, if the committee accepts that retrospectivity might be a problem, that this proposal would most probably then cover the whole issue to the extent that the offences currently being covered will then still apply retrospectively, and then all the other offences in respect of the Act itself, those convictions will then be covered prospectively. However, it was indicated to the committee that the retrospectivity will in all likelihood will probably be justified in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution if we take into consideration that these provisions are enacted in an attempt to protect vulnerable persons. I don't know whether you would like me to pause here or whether I should proceed, Chair. I'm going to pause maybe just to receive an indication whether we've got questions here.
Not yet.
Thank you, Chair. Then we'll proceed. And I'm just drawing through the provisions.
Chair, can we go a little bit, I want to check the last part, yes. Thank you, on the, yeah, Can I see, look at the last part of it? Any offenses in terms of chapter 2? Okay. External law and all this. Okay. No, thank you very much. It was actually something that was maybe me, but it's okay. Thanks.
Okay. I must indicate to you, and the wording of paragraph of this proposal was presented to the committee previously, but the wording of paragraph B was a bit different. Mm-hmm. I actually made a technical mistake to refer to the offences referred to in paragraph A, but paragraph B now reads very similar to the definition of what a sexual offence is in terms of the act. So I do apologize, Chair. I made a technical mistake previously, but fortunately I have picked it up. So we corrected that point.
Thank you. I thought I was dreaming. I was making a note of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, sorry, I forgot to, but fortunately it was picked up.
Yeah, I would just propose an amendment on that, please. Under B, can we just go to the end of B? 2020 will be 2021, probably, won't it?
Indeed, Mr. Chair. But, yeah, all right.
Am I correct?
That is the one thing that I cannot explain to you, Mr. Swart, because I'm not entirely sure how it happens when they go to... Parliament approves a bill in 2019, but it's signed by the President in 2020. But I think it carries the original numbering, so it remains a 2020 Act. But I will follow up on that, and we'll fix that for you.
Sorry, Chair, there's no waste time on that. We can leave that. But is that a reference to the present bill we're dealing with?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So then it would be 2021 probably or later. Thank you.
Let's allow him to go and double check and come back to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just mentioning this to you. It is quite obvious. We've already discussed this. And that is the whole issue of, since the definition of vulnerable persons will be extended to include more than the current two categories, once again the question is raised with regard to access to and congregate. And we just note again for the committee's convenience that there's actually two options, either to restrict those terms to children and persons who are mentally disabled, or then to omit those requirements, which I think the department would tend to recommend to the committee at this stage. And then we've just once again indicated to you how those proposed amendments will look like if they are restricted to children and persons who are disabled. Of course, referring to paragraph B of the definition of person is vulnerable, which will then include, for example, persons with sensory disabilities. Once again, just scrolling through the provisions, this is the provision which deals with the public access to the record. Previously, we were requested to provide the committee with options where persons who were children at the time of the commission of the offence should be protected, as well as children who might be identified when the particulars of an offender is made public. And then there's an option two, Mr. Chair, where the alternative for any person to apply to the registrar to be informed whether a person's particulars have been included in the register or not. The department is concerned about both options. So I don't know, and I think this is the part that will possibly lead to the larger part of the fight by the committee. So we would not want to say too much at this stage, and maybe be guided by the committee. And if there are questions, we will respond to the best of our ability. So the two options are then relating to the public availability of the particular subject.
So if you're concerned with the two options, what are you proposing?
Yeah, information.
Before you even go to, before he answers you, and then even if that is the case, what is actually the department doing about it, and did they consult enough and look at all the submissions that came through? They can be worried, but they must be able to put something on the table.
Honorable Horn.
Yeah, Chair, maybe Mr. Depree can firstly just inform us what the concern is with option two, because it's quite clearly clear, unless I read option two incorrectly, that this will address the whole issue of the wholesale publicity of the register. If one was a reasonable and valid interest in getting the information applies on the prescribed form, and quite possibly we could also ask advice of Dr. Lewis, who also gave us the advice about the inherent dangers in making the register public, what her opinion on this would be from Parliament's legal services side.
Before you answer, Dr. Lewis, Mr. Dupree, Ms. Porter, and then Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, this is going to become a long-winded answer, and I apologize in advance. The South African Law Reform Commission, when they submitted their report on sexual offences in, if I remember correctly, 2003 or 2004, they recommended that there should not be a register of sex offenders, primarily because, among others, they argued that it creates a false sense of security to the extent that a national register for sex offenders only contains the particulars of persons have been convicted of sexual offences. So it cannot predict whether a person will offend against a child or a person who's mentally disabled. So it's easy for teachers to be employed and his or her particulars does not appear on the register, and only afterwards they commit offences against children or persons who are mentally disabled. If you look at option two, I don't know how to explain it to you, Chair, but there's two things that concerns the department at this stage with regard to option two, or even option one. We are actually creating two different procedures. There's an existing procedure for employers to follow a certain or to comply with certain requirements which could arguably be considered as arduous. They have to go through an application process. While we create a second procedure for any person, any member of the public, to apply to the registrar to be able to receive an indication whether a person's particulars appear on the register or not. The purpose for employers to apply is quite clear. Option three does not really provide us with the purpose for why a person will be able to apply to the registrar. And then on a technical note, there have been struggling with, and I don't really know how to get past it, is if you look at paragraph B, paragraph B empowers the registrar to grant a request by indicating whether the particulars of a person concerned have been included in the register. So if you apply, you will in all likelihood receive the paragraph B1 notice. But if you look at the paragraph B2 notice, the registrar may refuse to request the confirmation of that particular may identify a person who was a child complainant or a person who is mentally disabled against whom the offence was committed. So the registrar can say, yes, Mr. ABC's particulars are included in the register, or the register can say, the registrar can say, Mr. ABC's particulars are not included in the register. But as soon as the registrar refused the request, strictly speaking, then that is actually confirmation that a person's particulars are on the register. So that's sort of the conundrum that we're facing with this provision. But Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Bertha to interrupt me and possibly take this explanation further for the committee.
Chairperson, can I go ahead? It's Ina speaking. Hello? Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Ina.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yeah, I agree with what my colleague has said. One of the things that was bothering us all, let me that what other possible option can we look at? And we saw this may there's a lot of dangers regarding that. The other thing is that in my view, the problem is that the refusal, it's only on two grounds, and that is in paragraph, subparagraph B, and actually one ground, that the particulars of the individual may identify a person who was a child complained or a person who is mentally disabled against whom the offence was committed. So the registrar is given a very wide discretion here. And what becomes for me personally difficult is, if you look at this kind of provision, immediately you must look at the promotion of access to information. If we talk about reasons, you must look at the promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So there's so many acts involved in this piece of legislation, if we take option two, that it is problematic for me for the reasons that Hank mentioned, but also that I have tried to explain to you.
Chairperson's permission, can I comment?
Chairperson, we don't see you. Chairperson, are you there?
Sorry, Honorable Mufuke, Dr. Lord, and then Honorable Mufuke.
I was checking you because we kept on calling.
Yes. My apologies. I think I was muted. Honorable Dr. Lut and then Honorable Mfuke.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members. Chairperson, through you, I think the options and the concerns that colleagues from the DOJ pointed out are fair and well-founded. You have the whole like information aspect that is there. You have the fact that it changes the especially option two then changes the scope and purpose that provision was crafted for in the form that our register currently has as being closed and for those purposes, for employment purposes. Chair, the committee at a previous meeting asked me to do some comparative research from the African continent, and I found something that today, just reading through Kenya's legislation, that I think makes it easier for me than what we currently have, in that they split the aspects. They have a register like South Africa's one that has the details and somebody applies and gets that, but then they also do what they call a DNA dangerous sex offenders, and somebody is declared a dangerous sex offender by the court when they are sentenced, and then the court can also place them under an extended supervision. So once that person who has been declared a dangerous sex offender gets out of prison, the court can say that for the next 5 or so years, that person must be monitored. So there's a supervision aspect to it, which also includes rehabilitation. And that reminded me of the discussion that was in the deliberations and the public participation of the possible use of the SAPS records. That, because currently as we have it now, if you open our register, there's no differentiation between the type of sexual offenses, whether somebody is a habitual like sex offender, a dangerous one, or it's the risk to that I pointed out with regard to the constitutional rights and those linked to the sex offender, the child and the families and all of that. We're kind of like grouping everybody under one label, and I think the concern of safeguarding the public and providing that safety and security without falling into the trap as a the police through records monitor that the dangerous sex offenders, that DNA data bank approach that Kenya has, makes sense to me. But that is, I'm throwing the cat amongst the pigeons. That's something that. Yeah, I was contemplating. I think just trying to to form the register and the provision that we currently have to open it up to a system that it was not designed to fit into is a concern. Thank you, Chair.
Can I suggest that Ms. Lutz and the department work on a few more other options, because we are still far from concluding this bill. We can come back to this issue later on. We move to other clauses. We will come back to this one maybe next week.
Okay. Chairperson.
Madam Mfuke.
I think I agree with you, and Dr. Lewis is correct that we were looking at other options because we had to do research into other countries. Mm-hmm. We also have the African leg, but also have US and others. And I think that we must be careful, especially this is one of the items that they were coming very strong in all the presentations. We can rush or want to rush to pass this bill, but we must be very careful because what all the challenges that are there of our laws, right to information and all that, will come into space. And I really wish that we must make sure that we can rather do the best work and adopt later, but make sure that South Africans are happy. even if it has to make us to call submissions on this part, let it be. That is my view, Chairperson. And I'm saying this as a gender activist. I might be a member of parliament, but that is something that I know is a thorn in so many organizations. Let us not play with it or say that we leave it from the departments only. Also, stakeholders must guide us into the whole thing. But options of all the research is very important. And I really want to thank you, Dr. Lewis. I saw all those papers, and actually they made me even more confused. And I wonder, where are we now? In fact, we made a mistake even with what we had before. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will come back to this clause later on. Further work needs to be done. Let's proceed with other clauses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just once again to highlight to you, nothing changed here except for having corrected the spelling mistake. The proposed new paragraphs for section 44B and 44C relating to the powers of the National Commissioner of Stats, and then also obligations on the Director General of Home Affairs, where a person's identity has been changed. So these two provisions were presented to the committee previously. We haven't received any instructions to change them, so they have remained the same. And then we will move to the provision where we talk about children who are in custody and care, and a person who is then the curator or, for example, the adopted parent of such a child and has been convicted of a sexual offence, the child must be removed. The paragraph B is the paragraph that was is the paragraph that appears in the introduced version of the bill. You will recall that the department has proposed that the portion in yellow should be included in the amendment bill, and the concern was raised in the committee that it does not place the responsibility on a specific official to do so. We are at the moment referring to section 152 of the Children's Act, but we will most probably like to maybe just change the reference to that specific section and rather refer to the relevant chapter dealing with the scenarios in terms of which children might be moved from to the first. I don't know whether there is any questions in this regard there.
Honorable Mfokeng, is that a new question, a new hand or an old hand?
Oh, sorry, the old hand. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. No question. You can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, there's not much left with regard to the first part of the bill or the bill that's introduced. In other words, keeping the register for Chapter 6 as it is. That part proposal was also submitted to the committee previously. It did not solicit any comments, so it remains there as a proposal to be included in the bill itself. The paragraph 4 deals with the applications for the removal of your particulars from the register, and the department recommended to the committee that the option should rather be considered to ensure that people who qualify for the removal of their particulars but who haven't done so yet after the commencement of the Amendment Act should be able to apply for such removal. So it's a technical issue, Chair, that the department would like to recommend to the committee that the original clause 4 be amended accordingly as proposed in the option. I don't know This also doesn't solicit any comments or discussion previously, but I will pause your chair just to find out whether there are questions today.
Proceed, Dr.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, this is a technical amendment being proposed. We have discussed it at the previous meeting. It is correcting the long title of the Principal Act to refer to the offence of sexual intimidation. The rest remains the same. But Chair, there's one important thing that I should just mention to the committee. If you look at clause 3.1, the short title and commencement, the reason why this amendment act will not commence on the date of publication thereof in the text is that there are the chapter 6 regulations that will have to be adapted according to the amendments. My apologies, that's just a gap in extra space. And then we are back at the position where the...
Sorry, Chair.
Mr. Swart?
Can I just ask Mr. Dupria, should that also not then, I'm missing something here, should that not also be 2020 in red to check that? Or is that a different section?
Mr. Chair, yes. No, don't worry, I'll troll through the whole bill and make sure about that. It's a difficult question. I'll have to consult with Mr. Neil Bell of the Bill's office. He'll be able to provide us with guidance. But I'll get back to the committee on that question. And then, Chair, I'm not going to really take you through this portion. We've already done that. This portion gives us an indication or aims to give the committee an indication how the provisions will look like when the functions of the register is then transferred to the Criminal Record Center of the South African Police Service. So I don't know whether you want me to go through it again. I think the only thing that we've added here, strictly speaking, is the debate in the committee at the previous meeting, whether it should be restricted to sexual offences or whether it should be extended to all previous convictions. Our recommendation is to say that as far as the prohibition of employment is concerned, it should remain with sexual offences. However, of course, if an employer gets access to a police clearance certificate, it will reflect the sum total of the person's previous convictions, whether they are more than only sexual offences. But if we want to stay within the ambit of this Act and this chapter, we will have to restrict the prohibition with regard to sexual offences only. Chair, I need your guidance, please. We've already done this, so I don't know whether you want me to go through each provision again. The only changes that have really been affected here are those dealing with a question, whether it should be restricted to sexual offences, or whether it should be extended to all of them. Thank you, Chair. I'll be guided by you.
Point us to areas where you have made changes. Don't repeat areas where we have already...
It's consequential in nature. Where you see the yellow, that was presented to the committee previously. Where you see the blue, that is where we simply made provision for the extension beyond sexual offences. So everywhere where you see it's consequential in nature, you will see that where you find the blue, you will get.
Can you go up? Can you go up so that we take members through? We don't appear to be. Yes, chapter. Go up. Go up. Let's go to the. Yes. Yes, let's start here. Let's take members through. Members, do you have any problems with the transfer functions to the South African Police Service Criminal Record Center? All the consequential amendments made there. Can you go down, Mr. Dupris? Are we fine with this? Please go down.
Yes, Chair, that's the proposed amendments to the index to chapter 6.
Yes, are we fine with 4.41? Go down.
Mr. Chair, if I may interrupt or maybe just raise the question, would you prefer that option to remain? Or could we take out that option and say that the prohibition is then restricted to sexual offences?
That is the question we are putting to members. What is the view of the members? Honourable Mfuken?
I think a previous conviction, because you might find some people don't have only on sexual offences, but other things.
Yes. So you are fine with the previous convictions?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other view? Thank you very much. Let's go down.
I don't want to belabor the matter, but there is a concern if we extend it to previous convictions, because then it takes the inclusion of previous convictions takes us beyond the ambit of Chapter 6, which is restricted to sexual offences. However, if a potential employer has access to a person's clearance certificate, it will include all convictions. However, the prohibition is recommended should be restricted to sexual offences, because then we remain within the ambit of Chapter 6. Just to mention maybe that you choose. And then this.
Mr. Dupris?
Yes, Chair.
If a person has a previous conviction of murder, which is a violent offence, would that person not have a propensity to commit other serious offences, especially with regard to children?
Yes, Chair. I cannot argue with that. I agree with you. I'm just merely cautioning the committee that one should take care that we stay within the ambit of Chapter 6 and the Act itself. The prohibition, I'm just referring to the prohibition. The prohibition is extended to all convictions. Then we are beyond the ambit of Chapter 6 and most probably moving in the direction of labor leaders. That's merely the point that I would want to make. Cheers.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, then we're back at a duplication actually of the provisions of Chapter 6, and then also the proposed amendments as they were discussed with the committee previously, except then of course for extending it, the proposal is to extend it, the distinctions in respect of all offences. I don't know whether you want me to go slowly, clause by clause, to get the question of money, just the committee members rather getting the opportunity to read the document. These proposed amendments are very similar to the ones that we discussed earlier, and we once again just highlight the whole issue of access to or congregate for the committee, and then we also, the proposal here is the first two options that are available in that regard. I will attempt to, there's not really much that I can highlight to the committee, which is new information since the previous committee meeting. I'm just checking here. Sorry, Chair, I don't want to waste the committee's time. I just want to ensure that there's nothing else or new that I need to highlight to the committee. Really at the end of the document, which is just, I just need to say thank you for your patience with me. You will see here, and you will recall we indicated here that a large number of provisions will be omitted in the register to SAPS. This transitional provision is proposed, I think we'll have to possibly meet with SAPS and just establish whether this is really necessary. But we will report back to the committee on this issue. Chair, we're actually, oh yes, and then, oh, well, we've already indicated this to the committee as well. And Dr. Lewis referred to a DNA database, and I don't want to preempt the discussions, or the internal discussions that we'll have with Dr. Lewis. But strictly speaking, we've already got a database. And that is precisely what we see here, is Section 360 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which provides for certain bodily samples to be taken and scored by the police, which could be used in investigation of offences. These are merely consequential amendments that must be effected to two provisions in the Criminal Procedure Act and then also one provision in the Police Service Act as a result of the possibility of the register being referred to SAPS Criminal Record Center. So yes, Chair, those are also self-explanatory. I'm at the end of my document. I don't know whether you would like me to highlight something at this stage.
Your meeting with SAPS was supposed to have been long done. We are about to conclude the bill. So if you are saying to us you still have to meet with SAPS, when will that meeting be?
Chair, we have met with SAPS, and I must admit, when I read through the document this morning again, I'm just looking for that repetition. I was just concerned, and the question came up personally, whether it is really necessary to have the transitional provision of this nature. So, and that is a discussion that will not take longer than 5 minutes, Chair. So it's just a question of making sure that we're advising the committee correct. It's not a question of us having to meet at length with them. But I just, as a drafter, I just started doubting whether it's really necessary.
Okay.
So
when we meet on Tuesday, you would have met with them?
Yes, certainly, Chair. It's not even going to be a meeting. It's going to be a phone call, Chair.
Very good. Honorable Swart?
I'm sorry. I just want to at the heart of this call is the definition of vulnerable woman, page 10, FEMA under page 25. At this point, the department and the legal advisors, Parliament, I'm just concerned about why that's on page 10. Why would we only consider students, the interns, doctors, nurses? What about your unemployed people that are young, that can't go to university, that are just as vulnerable? Are we not? And I fully appreciate this is an incredibly difficult definition, but should it not be FEMA under the age of 25 years or, because surely, including, because surely those females that are under the age of 25, that are not going to university, not internships, or why should they not enjoy the protection of being a vulnerable person just because they're not an intern, they're not a student, but they are possibly unemployed in the communities? We've got many, many such women, and that's just something that I want the protection to be as broad as possible. And I realize it's not easy, but I don't want anyone to be excluded from that particular definition. Sorry to take us back, Chair.
Well, I think it was before you joined, Honorable Swart, to discuss that matter extensively. And we said that they must go back and look at a broader definition that would cover, we raise more or less the same issues that you raised, that the definition as it stands now, it excludes quite a number of other vulnerable categories. So they are going to redraft that subsection B to take into consideration all of these issues that we have raised.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I know it's late, and we had a discussion previously about the age of 25. But again, this is something we need to really deliberate on about that age as well. But let's leave it at this stage. I appreciate the work that's been done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mfuke.
One appreciates what the Honorable Swart is going back to, because the issue of 25 years was discussed, because it doesn't mean if you're over 25, you might not be vulnerable. And I think and I agree that we still need to look at this matter of 25 years. Thank you.
It's not only so it's 25 and people from 60. It just go down, Mr. Chris. Persons of 60 years of age or older. I do think that, honorable members, we also need to put also some agency into the issues that we want to have them deliberated upon, because we have to balance two extreme issues here. We have to balance the fact that we need to have a bill that is going to protect these vulnerable groups, the bill that is going to assist in the fight against gender violence, a bill that is constitutional. And at the same time, we cannot run away from the fact that we are under immense pressure as Parliament to ensure that we meet all of these things. But we need to meet them yesterday. That is the reality of the matter. So I would ask that when we come back next week to deliberate on the bill, we must have some more or less tentative views on what we want to be changed or to be modified, extended in the bill, so that we are working on an operative date of the 12th, and there's something extraterrestrial comes. Also, we need to bear in mind that the same process is going to start afresh from the NCOP when the bill is passed. Let's say it is passed by the MA, it goes to the NCOP. I saw that there are some people who are suggesting further public consultation. The same process is going to start again from the NCOP. The NCOP is going to invite again public comments. But it is important that the NA should pass a bill that is constitutional, that is going to assist in the fight against gender-based violence, a bill that is not flawed. To the best of our ability, we must ensure that we meet all of these criteria. I have Honorable Mfokeng, Honorable Nivo Tachans, Honorable Swart. Ms. Porter, do you still want to speak or is it an old hand?
So thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say is that if Parliament goes the route of doing away with the register and that people will, the employers will have to go to SAP, of course that the bill will look completely different, half of it, than it looked like when we introduced it. The second thing is that I just want to say to you is, it's the meeting that Henk was referring to. We had a meeting with SAPS, and what SAPS wanted to bring to our attention, and I think just maybe I can refresh the memory of the members, was to say, if we change the bill to read that the employers must just get a clearance certificate, which means it will show all the offences that this person has been convicted of, it would not that be problematic. But the moment if we're going to ask them to only focus and take out or extract the sexual offences, it's going to be a little bit more difficult and they will need resources, etc. But I think that we just need to speak when we are going to speak to them about this other thing. Just get more information on that matter as well. Thank you.
Yes. The clearance certificate would include all other offences, including sexual offences. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. That is correct.
So it does not exclude sexual offences?
It doesn't exclude it, and it does include it. So if we want to say we want the employers only to be informed about sexual offences, that the processes of the SAPS will have to change a little bit, because presently they don't have a system that only reflects the sexual offences. It has all the kind of offences that this person has committed on their system. So we just need to check to them again about the other issue of separating them, the sexual offences, from their database. Thank you.
And then Ms. Botha, generally when you engage with them, how much in terms of resources will it require them to change to this new requirement if we are to approve it with the current formulation? And whether that has been budgeted for in the medium term?
Chair, yes, I recall that at one stage, one of the earlier discussions, Brigadier van Rooyen of SAPS, she was here and she made a like comment or presentation on this whole issue, and I know that they were talking about costing, so we will also alert them to the fact that if that is the second option, what is the cost implication? But I can say, for to you is that What they did say is they have not made provision for this extra extracting or system that will enable them to extract the sexual offences from the normal SAP 69. But we will get back to the committee on that and ask maybe them also, with your permission, that they can give a layout of the cost, because they will know best out what it means and what it entails. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Botha. Honorable Nivot Tracha.
It was not for game before Nivot, but it's okay, Chair.
Game before Nivot, but it's okay, Chair. Chair, who should speak first? I'll leave it to my whip. Honorable Mufukeng, you can start before me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Chair, I think what Dr. Botha has explained now, these are some of the things that are very disturbing, especially when it comes to budget and we talk about the gender-based issues. Women have died in this country, women and children. And we even said, when the president was addressing the matter, to say budget should not be an issue. Women must be prioritized. And if we have to wait for subs to do the costing and all that, it cannot be right. It cannot be right. Let that issue not come to us. We want the right thing to happen. And the other thing is that why should we talk about things as if we are not looking at the fourth industrial revolution, where we'll be able, with a button, you can check information and know where things are. We talk as if we are still on manual. Chair, that is unacceptable. We must register it now. Thank you.
Honorable Stephen Swart.
Chair, not Honorable Drucken, is it not?
Honorable members, if we are going to share all of us, it's going to be a problem.
May I go ahead?
Yes.
Just very briefly, I am concerned that bills, when we pass a bill, they must be costed. That is the challenge, where we've passed bills in the past and they're not implemented. So I do understand the urgency and what the Honorable Mafeking said, that if we are changing the bill to significantly to shift the register there, and there are cost implications, we need to know what it is, because that is incumbent on us. It's the end of the bill. It says the costing of the bill. So I think that cannot delay the matter, but we need to know if there are implications, because we can't have a situation later where the SAP says, but we warned you. So that is one point. Secondly, the issue relating to the certificate. I've got a question, and I just want to know whether at the moment, can any employer approach the SAPs for a SAP 69 paying a fee? Because as it is presently worded, if it's a broader, there's a dual sword here. Firstly, depending if we go for only access for certificates relating to sexual offences, then there is a problem with implementation. Honourable Mafeking suggested all offences, but does that mean that if you as an employer get a certificate and you have an employer and you've got an employee that committed theft, and now you say, no, you may not work with children because you committed theft, there could be discrimination and it could be unconstitutional. So these are aspects we need to look at carefully. The last point I want to raise is something that arose from our discussion this morning with the Chief Justice and some of the issues relating to the courts. And this is a broader issue. This is something we might want to refer to in our report. That is the whole issue of post-traumatic stress of victims of sexual offences. Firstly, the physical conditioning of the courts, relating to that being secondary trauma of having to give evidence. And we heard the example that was given by the Chief Justice. The probably a broader issue, which I don't quite know the answer to, but is the stress that victims of sexual offences have to undergo generally, post-traumatic stress.
And whilst this bill allows for prophylactics for rape and that type of thing, but surely as a responsible parliament, there should be some mechanism to allow for psychological counselling treatment. We don't have to put it in the bill, but for women that have psychological post-traumatic stress syndromes, and that is something we need to also look at. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Nick Woodruffin.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I'm sorry, I don't want to take us back. There's something that's just been bothering me. All of this is for adults at an adult level. But for children who are below the age of 18 and convict gender-based violence crimes, you know, are they covered as well? So I'd just like to find out.
Thank you. Honorable Masuko Zela.
Thank you, Chairperson. My apology for being absent for some few minutes also. But I think, Chairperson, what made me to raise my hand on this issue, it is that little report that we have just got from Ms. Bot. It really, I think, it, like my colleague, Honorable Mfokeng indicated, I am so disappointed that we are still here talking. The police, it seems as if to me, this matter is not being taken serious. So by the police, I think when they came here and do the presentation, Chairperson, it was clear, it was indicated. I'm sure it's me, if I'm not mistaken, we did indicate that they have to look at all the issues of costing, even to our department. That issue of costing, in order that this bill has have to be implemented without any problems when it comes to that, it was discussed, Chairperson. So we're still sitting here talking about that issue. It is very disturbing. And the issue of perpetrators, it's like the issue of saying if, for example, if we're going to the register the perpetrators, for example, their names are going to be exposed like that, and it can be a detriment even to the like the father raped the child. So if you put the father on the register, obviously they will know that it is the child. Who is that child? I think we have to look into that one, that issue, even if we don't say this, we don't give more details on this one. It cannot be said like put clear like that to say he raped the child. This perpetrator raped his own child. We can put it in another way. Like, for example, we can put it that, in fact, in the register, we just list them and say, these are the perpetrators of GBV, and without indicating that it was the victim was the child, his child. But I'm of the view that with all the explanation that has been given, Chairperson, this issue, it's very serious. This, I'm not sure if maybe because I didn't hear other debates before, if other people have agreed on this not to be publicized or whatever. I will continue listening because I've missed a lot on this one. I didn't hear it clearly, but I was disturbed by the comment about the police. I agree with Honorable Mofokeng that we are now in the fourth industrial revolution. Things must happen in a different manner. We can't think like we are still that, I repeat her words, we can't think like we are still in the old dispensation. So other things must change. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And let me firstly say I don't want to be sound as if I want to contradict anything that is based or founded in the emotions around all of this, but I want to say that I think it's a bit unfair to be cross with Mrs. Botha and the Department of Justice now for them simply stating what really should be for us as members of Parliament fairly obvious, and that is that the ability of the SAPs to take over the functions is budget dependent. So I understand all of the issues. I mean, I was also present when we were, I think, as a committee, fairly uncomfortable with the initial, one of the initial briefings we received from the SAPs in this regard. But that has nothing to do with the way Treasury works and the consequential ability from SAPs to take this over or not. So in an attempt to be constructive in this regard, since there are some homework for the department, I think we should then also consider asking whether the wording could be phrased in such a way that there is the possibility at a later stage for the South African Police Services to take over these functions. I mean, it must follow, if one just purely talks from a budgetary perspective, that while there is a register in place, currently the Department of Justice will have budget and will hopefully again receive budget in terms of the newest allocation. So the request is that we be advised as to whether that can be phrased in such a way. And that's of course dependent on us as a committee to conclude that ultimately the responsibility should rest with the SAPs. A good arguments have been made out to that effect, but on the other hand, it is also so that the department has, while there has been struggles with the credibility and the integrity of the register at some stages, it's not insurmountable problems. So that's the one issue, Chair. I sort of have the impression that you asked us to give a feedback as to what we're looking for towards Tuesday, and unfortunately things got a bit, I don't want to say, let me not say it. But in dealing with what we're looking for towards Tuesday, I think the other big issue in linking or adding my voice to what others have said, specifically the Honorable Swart, is the remaining doubts about the definition of definitions around vulnerability. So I think not only the department, but all of us must go and carefully think about that issue, specifically if it is going to need a legislative amendment going forward to amend what we deem as a country to be the vulnerable groups that should be afforded special protection. So that's just possibly in conclusion in this regard, my input, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Horn, Honorable Horn. Ms. Botha.
Thank you, Chair. I just thought I will respond to what Steve said about the issue of what the Chief Justice raised this morning about traumatization of the victims. I know it's not going to solve the problem now, but for purposes of the information of the members, I thought I can, for those of you who may not have been part of that process, just refer then to the fact that we have on the 31st of January, if I'm not mistaken, we have implemented the legislation that allows for the designation of sexual offences courts, where the court rolls will have only sexual offences on, and that there will be additional services available in order to try and prevent the secondary traumatization of the victims. On the 7th of February, if I'm not mistaken, regulations were issued indicating what are the minimum requirements that these courts will have to comply with. And I know one of the chief directorates now in justice is busy now with the process of designation in the sense of identifying courts. I know it's a very slow start, but I thought I just want to mention to you that we trust that not long in future we will have a few courts where we will have very good services available to our victims, including court preparation officer services, where you explain to the victim what he or she can expect in court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mufuke.
Chairperson, I think one of my colleagues said the Chief Justice explained a number of things this morning. And with due respect, Dr. Boda, it was said to us that the sexual offences courts, according to him, I might not be quoting him verbatim, is that it's the same court with the same manager, with the same magistrate or presiding officers, and with everything, nothing has changed. And so when we say that we are dealing with a sexual offences court, we must check what are we talking about. Because we're talking about backlogs and resources. And even now, one, we might be taken that we are perturbed about the whole thing, is because we have a history. The Domestic Violence Act that has been there, our police officers failed us at the entry. Some of them didn't know what the domestic violence is actually what it means. They didn't even know that that economic abuse. They knew little about it. So when we deal with this, we must be given an opportunity to express ourselves and things that we have seen them happening as experience, say them as they are, so that we can be able to heal the wounds of South Africans. Women ahead. And listening to what the Chief Justice has said today, I'm very worried. And I think we will have our opportunity as we do an oversight over the department and ask, is it true what we heard about today about the sexual offences court? Thank you very much, Chairperson, and for allowing us to air our views, because it's hurting. It's hurting. I must say that the things that you just get and then we want to smile about them and coasting and all that, it cannot be right. Unfortunately, we have to deal with this, and we are not doing it for ourselves, but for the South Africans and for those that we have seen, their families have died, and for those that are still struggling with all those challenges. As we deal with it, let us remember what is happening now or what happened before. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. We will meet on Tuesday. A special focus should be on the issue of the definition of the vulnerable groups. There was an issue raised on sexual offences, the issue of retrospectivity. I think we might need to go back to it. And then the issue about this issue of the register, I think is one of the thorniest issues that we would need to deal with. But I do think that we are on track to ensure that we deliver a quality bill with all the challenges that have been mentioned. I do think that the department must give us more options, especially on the issue of the register, so that we can be able to apply our minds having a variety of options on that issue of the National Register for Sexual Offences. and the issue, I think the two most emotive issues are the vulnerable groups, that's definition, and the issue of the National Register for Sexual Offences. So on Tuesday, we will have two meetings. One meeting, it will be in the morning. And in the afternoon, we are going to be in the house because we are passing the three, our BRRR reports and the recognition of customary marriages appeal on Tuesday. So after that, we will meet again in the evening to recap on what we would have discussed in the morning. We would be meeting between now and the 12th of March. We'll be meeting morning, afternoon, and evenings to ensure that we cover a lot of ground in ensuring that these bills are at a stage where they can be presented before the National Assembly. Thank you very much, honorable members, and to everybody, our stakeholders that are part of us. Thank you very much for your attendance. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.